It's the P.Z. Myers Who edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, updating past segments, the police state, interview with P.Z. Myers, and what's up with the Who. Now let's begin episode 118.
Welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free-thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. It's been a busy, busy week, hasn't it, Ethan?
It's been really busy.
Yeah.
Busier than, well, I guess last week.
True. So, Ethan, I understand you have some somewhat sad, disheartening, happy, weird... Any news?
Well, you know, speaking of sort of sad, disheartening, somewhat sad news, I found out a few weeks ago that here at CITR, we've lost a few of our good friends who helped make this show possible. I want to give a shout out to Bryce Dunn and Luke Meat. Bryce was our programming coordinator and Luke was our musical director here at CITR. Both have moved on from these positions. Nevertheless, I wanted to express our thanks to Bryce and Luke for all their help getting Radio Free Thinker on the air, providing us with a lot of great feedback, and honestly, being very patient with some very green skeptics who frankly didn't have a clue what they were doing when they started.
That's true. You know, their patience, their willingness to give us an opportunity to come on the air, to do our thing, I think has not only helped CITR become a better station, help us be better skeptics, but again, provided a voice, a single radio voice in the Lower Mainland for skepticism that is spreading across southern BC and hopefully soon across the world. Thanks, guys.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, we don't see a skeptical show like ours very often on a campus radio station. And, you know, I wouldn't have been terribly surprised if someone had said at some point, you know, okay, your experiment is over, but that never happened. And instead, just the opposite. And I think that says a lot about the people at this station. So cheers to Bryce and Luke, and good luck with their future endeavors.
I concur. Speaking of fallouts, in fact, nuclear fallouts.
Ha ha ha.
I have that scripted laughter. So, it seems like things are not going well for nuclear power. Apparently, the number one nuclear reactor in Fukushima seems to have actually completely melted down. Germany has reversed its stance on nuclear power, saying it's going to get rid of them all by 2020. And we've done a few segments recently where we've touched on some of these issues. And I thought, as good skeptics, you should go back and say, hey, you know, what did we do right? What did we do wrong? You know, how are these topics doing today? And one of them is, you know, like I say, nuclear power is one of them. It seems like the disaster that happened in Fukushima is a lot worse than they were letting on at the time. Actually, I heard this morning that people are claiming that all three of the reactors had a complete meltdown, which only really means is that there's a little puddle of uranium in that at the bottom of a metal cylinder, which is not good, but cleanup is going to be horrific, long time, lots of radiation. I still think it doesn't negate the fact that nuclear power is better than coal energy. And in fact, the Japan and Germany have both said, you know, hey, we're going away from nuclear. But they've been kind of waffly about what they're going to go to. And I don't know if the world is going to be a better place if they replace the nuclear power with coal or oil-fired units. So.
Yeah. You know, this does kind of make me wonder if this is more of a matter of deflecting current criticism. And they might be saying now, we're abandoning nuclear power, but then in a few months when people aren't as concerned about it, or maybe in a few years when it's not on the front page of the newspaper, they'll quietly start going back to nuclear.
I don't know, because that's under the premise. I mean, one of the reasons why they kind of went to nuclear was green energy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and everyone who's been against nuclear power has said, well, we should replace it with green energy. But they seem more vocal to stop the nuclear than to promote the green, which... Mm-hmm.
That's kind of problematic.
And to be fair, Angela Merkel, going on with what you're saying, is, I believe, flip-flopped on this 3 times. And don't get me wrong, I don't think flip-flopping is a horrible thing. I mean, as new evidence comes to you, you should be willing to change your opinion on a particular issue, provided it's based upon the evidence and not upon political whims at the time, which perhaps her thinking is more on that. But speaking of whims, another issue we covered a little while ago is Libya and the perhaps necessity, as we saw it at the time, for the UN and NATO to go in and protect innocent civilians from being killed by their very own government. And at the time, a lot of people were saying, well, yes, that's the pretext, and it's only a pretext that once they start protecting, in quotes, the citizens, they're actually going to go for regime change. And oddly enough, it seems like they're going for regime change. A lot of the bombing now is not to protect civilians, but to either kill or get rid of Gaddafi directly without any even pretext on it.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I still think the original concept was good, but I have to admit, the empirical evidence shows that it doesn't seem to go down that road. Do you agree?
Well, it's a tricky matter because in order to perhaps safeguard these people, they feel it's necessary to remove the current regime. That being said, you'd think that they would find a better way of doing it than bombing him to oblivion rather than trying to capture him and perhaps put him on trial for war crimes or whatever. But it is a troubling development.
Well, and there's also the inconsistency that everyone brings up, that a very similar incident occurred in Bahrain. Similar things happen in Yemen. Even worse is happening right now in Syria, and it's like, oh, well, that's their country, and we shouldn't interfere in their internal events. And,
yeah.
So again, you know, it's mixed review on that. I think, again, principle right, but you're right, it's slippery slope. Everyone said there'd be a slippery slope. Lo and behold, there was a slippery slope. Another issue we covered recently was a ban on prayer at graduations. Damon
Fowler
had managed to sort of get a prayer banned from his school, although from school graduation, although that was somewhat sidestepped, because if I believe correctly, that at the graduation ceremony, the valedictorian actually, as part of her speech, said, hey, everyone, we weren't supposed to do a prayer, and I'm introducing the moment of silence, but I just want you all to know my God's bigger than yours, and we're right, he's wrong, sort of thing, and let's all pray. Big pray, big hoops, and not a very pretty sight.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, a couple in Texas won an injunction in... they're agnostic parents. They want an injunction to ban invocation and benediction at their child's graduation. Again, a huge media storm occurred over it, to the point where even the Republican Governor Rick Perry expressed how reprehensible it was to ban prayer in school, which, of course, anyone who knows American Constitution, there's a huge separation of church and state, and something that we as atheists and skeptics in Canada support wholeheartedly. The court actually repealed the ban. The couple won their ban in the first place, but repealed the ban on a very odd note, and one that I think should send a bit of a chill down, is it did it on the basis of free speech. It said that, well, you know, these people should have the right to do what they say, what they want to say. And the school itself went through some hoops to sort of say that people have a right to express their beliefs as opposed to say a prayer. But, you know, again, it was one of those sort of, there's a win, they got the ban, the law was on their side, and then somehow turned around and became very much of a horror story.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of, it's all about free speech. As soon as it stops being about Christians, as soon as it becomes atheists expressing their free speech, I'm sorry, your bus sign got torn down. Please pay $200 to get it back up.
Exactly. Or I wonder how much they would have been in support if it was, a Muslim prayer, if what they were doing, right? Or if some other...
A Satanist sort of prayer.
Yeah, you know, it was like, oh, hey, you know, that's your... No, we don't. But, oh, well. But another... small story that we actually covered this a while ago, but it has kind of grown wings. It was about a cell phone study that was done. At the time, we hinted that some would misrepresent the data, saying that in the study that there was an increased energy that was increased energy detected in the brain, and that this was caused by cell phone radiation. And actually, what's been misrepresented, or seems to have been misrepresented, in a study that has yet to be published, but it has been published informally, mm-hmm. That the increased energy was the radiation, i.e. that radiation was what the scientists were measuring in the brain. This, of course, as our listeners remember, when we did do this thing, is false. The energy in question is glucose, increased because of greater blood flow. The study was quick to mention that such energy surges are common in the human body and the brain. So if you're thinking about a math problem, you get these increased energy readings, among other things. Now, granted, you know, the... what's actually causing this particular increase is unknown. The lead scientist said, hey, we're not sure exactly why there's this increased blood flow, but we really should go in and do more research into it. It could be stimulation directly from microwave radiation that's done for it. Of course, it could also be stimulation of the skin outside that's causing some effect inside, or it might just be some weird effect caused by the phone itself, irrespective of the radiation induced. And of course, one of the other big issues, because everyone said, oh, well, this is a cause for concern because it's causing cancer and all that, and hopefully not to be corrected, or well, I guess I want to be corrected if I'm wrong, even if we accept that this stimulation in the brain is the direct result of radiation from the cell phone antenna, there still seems to be a complete absence, almost, of correlated data with brain cancers. Mm-hmm. That, you know, that it's almost the reverse of what happened with smoking. You know, back in the old days, you had smoking people had a lot of cancers, and the smoking industry says, well, yes, they might be getting cancer, but it's not caused by us. Whereas here, we seem to have, well, it's causing cancers, but we haven't seen them yet, but we know they'll be there. It's just, and somehow that the big issue seems to be that there's this big industry, the cell phone industry, that's behind it. And if there's a big industry behind it, it's got to be bad in some way. Mm-hmm. Now, again, you know, I mean, to be fair, it's technology. There's things that are going on. We need to do more research. I don't trust corporations, as people know, innately. I think we need to follow the science, though, and not necessarily our own political bias. And, you know, as long as we continue to do these testings, you know, cell phones are becoming more and more powerful. They're going to do more and more things. There may be a point in the future where they themselves may cause problems. If you live next door to a cell phone tower, which has magnitudes greater amount of radiation hitting you, I suspect that may have a much more significant effect on the human body than just what's coming out of your handheld. So I'm not exactly saying we should ignore it and trust the companies and say cell phones could never, ever cause a problem. But so far, there seems to be a whole lack of that.
Yeah.
That being said, recently, as most of our skeptics may or may not know, the WHO recently said, and I'm going to say this wrongly so as to be corrected, the WHO, which is the World Health Organization, said cell phones are killing our children with nuclear radiation, causing cancers that are bloating out the ears, or something like that. Ethan, what exactly is the WHO saying?
Yeah, not quite that bad, but it still was fairly bad. They released a press release, and that's really important. A press release, not a study or a research paper, a press release saying that cell phones have a possible connection to cancer. Now, newspapers and media being what it is, took this release and ran headlines saying, World Health Organization says cell phones cause cancer. And of course, that's not what's going on here at all. It's important to know that the World Health Organization took this story and ran with it when they really shouldn't have. They have a study that's actually supposed to come out, supposed to appear in The Lancet July 1st, but they didn't wait for that study to be released. All they've done is they've taken a conclusion that I think is dubious and pronounced it to the world and have allowed media to run with this in a very irresponsible fashion. So to quote what the WHO have actually said, they have a working group, which is what the scientists doing the research of are sort of called the working group, discussed and evaluated the available literature on the following exposure categories involving radio frequency electromagnetic fields. And they examined occupational exposures to radar and microwaves, environmental exposures associated with transmissions of signals of radio, television, and wireless communication, and personal exposures associated with the use of wireless telephones. According to the results, they classified the evidence for the possibility that cell phones, the cell phone use could cause cancer, glioma, acoustic neuroma as limited. Further, they classified the evidence that cell phone use could cause other types of cancers as inadequate. Now, you think with that, they would have said, okay, well, there's not any evidence here. Instead, they moved cell phones into a new classification. So the classifications, for people who are wondering, is a group one, which is carcinogenic to humans. So obviously things that are proven to be cancer-causing.
Like plutonium.
Sure. Group 2A, which is probably carcinogenic to humans. Group 2B, possibly carcinogenic to humans. Possibly not quite sure how they differentiate those. Group 3, not classifiable as to carcinogenic to humans. And group 4, probably not carcinogenic to humans. Cell phones were placed in the group 2B. Now, I think that's kind of irresponsible based on their own findings from this research.
Well, but I don't want to say to be fair, to be consistent. I looked at actually some of the things that are in the definitely and probably carcinogenic, and you get things like nickel is a carcinogen. Solar radiation emissions from deep fat frying and salted fish, Chinese style. Apparently salted fish. This is according to the WHO's list of known or suspected carcinogens in the list. So in the one sense, I suspect that there's a low bar that they have placed here to hurdle. Again, maybe, who knows, maybe every Chinese person who's had their salted fish has
gotten cancer.
But it's solar radiation. Again, it's one of those things that to say solar radiation causes cancer is a valid thing to say. That being said, to say if you go out in the sun, you're going to die from cancer is, well, that's not true either. There seems to be a lot of nuance missing from the list.
Yeah, and the other sort of major problem that I have with this is that the current research that we're evaluating about cell phones and cancer has basically been very clear that there's no plausible mechanism for which a cell phone could cause cancer. The energy that a cell phone emits is too low to mutate strands of DNA, which would cause cancer. And since cell phones don't contain, cancer-causing carcinogens like asbestos or something, there's no mechanism that would actually cause a tumor in your brain.
I do suspect they do have nickel in them.
Yeah, maybe nickel.
Maybe
nickel. In addition to that, you sort of have some other kind of factoids to consider. Like, there's currently 5 billion cell phones in use right now, and you'd think that with 5 billion phones in use, cancer rates would be increasing dramatically, but that's not consistent with the current data that's indicating that cancer rates are actually going down. Now, of course, this isn't science, but it's still kind of a discrepancy that you would think proponents of the cell phone cancer relation would have to address at some point. And another interesting study that, different from the one that you mentioned, is the Interphone study. And that was a study done in 13 different countries looking for any sort of link between cell phone use and two types of brain cancer. And the study had a case control of 2,708 glioma patients, and then another 2,000 or so cancer patients with matching controls, and the results were that a link between cell phone use and cancer was just not supported. So,
but Ethan,
yeah,
who funded those supports? I mean, you know that we got our check in from Nokia.
Sure, right. Sure. I got mine.
Right. So, I mean, everyone's going to say, well, you know, this is just a part of, you know, the big cover up. Does that factor into any of these studies you've read about? I mean,
well, I actually don't remember who funded the Interphone study, but there's lots of great posts about it already out there. I was looking at a post by Orac at Respectful Insulin, which is a great resource, by the way, and he actually had some critical things to say about the Interphone study, but again, he kind of just reiterated the point that because there's no mechanism to even study at this point, it's really dubious to even suggest that cell phones are having this effect. And then another great study that I heard about, which was recently published in the American Journal of Epidemiology, suggested that if cell phones are causing cancer, and it's because of the energy they emit, because cell phones only emit energy to a certain distance, the tumors should be in parts of the brain closest to where you hold the cell phone. So they did a study of people who have brain cancer, and I guess they tried to figure out where they hold their phone to see if their tumors were near the phone. And that evidence didn't prove anything. There was no correlation between where you hold your phone and where you get the tumor. So, I mean, I think that alone is kind of telling. And then getting back to Orac, who I was reading extensively when doing research for this, and he suggested that at worst, cell phones are either group 3, not classifiable as carcinogenic to humans, or group 4, probably not carcinogenic to humans, and not group 2B. And I think he even said something kind of, what were the people at the WHO smoking when they decided this one? So I have to kind of side with him on that.
But smoke is one of the one or two carcinogens, depending on what the smoke is.
Yeah.
Well, but correct me if I'm wrong, too. They say it's radio, what was the exact cancer-causing agent that they cited? Radio wave?
In theory here, it's radio frequency electromagnetic fields.
So, again, you know, this is like solar radiation in one sense, right? I mean, they don't actually say cell phones. They may have meant cell phones. They may have explicitly said it in other parts. But, I mean, you know, the idea that maybe radio wave radiation at a certain intensity over a certain period of time might be, but whether that comes from your cell phone seems to be a huge misclassification. And one of the things that really scares me and annoys me is the fact that because the WHO has done this, it has essentially laid itself open from any future high ground it might claim for other things that may genuinely be carcinogens. I mean, there's lots of talk about Bupropion B, certain plastics that are believed to be somewhat carcinogenic. There are new chemicals being produced every day by industry to do this, that, and the other, which may in the end prove to be carcinogenic. And if the WHO comes out and says, oh, well, you know, your plastic bottle is carcinogenic, the industry is going to say, oh, yes, but then they say your cell phone's carcinogenic too. You can't believe anything the WHO says.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it does a disservice, one, to the WHO's reputation, and two, to the potential good that the WHO could do.
Well, it's like that old quote from Marvel comic, with great power comes great responsibility, and the WHO is in a position of authority and an influence, and they have to be extremely careful with what they say. I mean, to give this another look, I mean, consider The Lancet, and they published Andrew Wakefield's study, and look how much damage that did their reputation. So, really, the WHO, I mean, pick it up, guys.
I was thinking of more of The Boy Who Cried Wolf, but, you know.
That's a good one, too.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll come back with more here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and The Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
And we're back here on Radio Free Thinker. So, Don, we're going to be discussing some skepticism of police states.
Yes, exactly. The segment title I wanted to use for this was, you know, Police State Watch. The idea of separating conspiracy hysteria from genuine concerns. The topic for this week, I think, is lawful access. The Harper government has recently announced its plans to reintroduce or introduce a omnibus crime bill that will, among other things, reintroduce changes to lawful access for government investigators. Now, I should point out that some of the text that I'm using is referenced to bills that died in committee, so they haven't actually didn't become laws. But because the Conservatives now have a majority, thanks to the punishment the citizens of this country gave them for election fraud and contempt of Parliament, we gave them majority just to prove that you can't do bad things in this country.
That'll teach them.
But it seems like these laws will pass. So first, what do we mean by lawful access? The term simply means that lawful officials, be they the RCMP, CSIS, which is sort of our CIA, FBI rolled up into one, local cops like Vancouver Police Department, or, quote, appropriate government agents, can obtain information for a current investigation by either legal statute or warrant. The premise for a search warrant or the underlying explanation for this legal statute is when an investigator has direct evidence that an individual may be involved in direct criminal activity, then they can be granted essentially the power to go in and seize information, seize evidence in order to forward the particular case or to stop an imminent crime. Now, the laws in question, one of the laws that failed and that's probably going to be reintroduced, is the Technical Assistance for Law Enforcement in the 21st Century. It sounds like some movie you'd find on Bugs Bunny or whatever, Duck Dodger in the 21st and a half century. But it would require ISP providers, so those are people who Shaw, Rogers, Cable, and all them, and other telecommunication providers, to install equipment facilitating the interception of communications and allow for instant access for police without a warrant or to persons who are deputized by the government. And these include things like names, addresses, telephone numbers, IP addresses. Essentially, it allows them to go in and find out where you've been, who you are. If you anonymously make a post on a forum, they can access the ISP and actually trace it. It was you that went there and did this, so you're no longer anonymous. They're also need to have the ability, as best as technology allows, to decrypt any transmission sent on their network. So essentially, if you think something's encrypted and private, it's probably not. Mm-hmm. Now, its stated intent is only to provide investigators with the ability to trace communications and create networks of connected individuals, which is true, but one of the things that you find is that now that they sort of have this ability, that which they weren't really denied before. I mean, in the past, if the RCMP came up to Rogers or Shaw Cable and said, we suspect this particular person is involved in people smuggling, or we think this guy's a kiddie porn or something like that, either a judge will give them a warrant, or if it's an immediate case, most providers will say, yes, here you go. There hasn't actually been a need for this law. But they now can just go in and they get this access automatically. In the United States, it's actually been a huge, huge issue because another part of it is it's been automated. So the police can just sort of type in and just tie into this information feed at will, without a warrant, without any justification. And in the United States, you had something like, they'd have like 100 requests. I'm using round numbers. They'd have like 100 requests a year for this kind of information. Once Sprint, it created this automated system, it was like a million requests in the same period of time. Mm-hmm. It was just because it was so easy to do. You know, and there's no criteria as far as do you need this information. It's there. I might as well grab it. Why not? One of the ways to see the possible issues is to compare it to its previous bill that it's going to be replacing, which is essentially the Personal Information Protection and Electronic Documents Act. They like long names in acts, don't they? That's why they always refer to it as C-61 or C-42, is because you have to give the full name of it. You'd be out of breath by the end of it.
I think it makes it sound cooler.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Although some of them have pretty, you know, the bill to embarrass the Democratic Party of the United States. It's been actually a bill. But anyhow, so the Personal Information Protection Electronic Documents Act, access to information by a government, the government institution that was asking for it had to identify itself, said, hey, my name is Bob, that it had lawful authority to do so. The request also had to be made for a specific purpose of law enforcement, and that carrying out the for a specific purpose of law enforcement and the carrying out of an investigation or gathering intelligence on a very specific crime. We basically said, hey, I need this information for this particular case for this particular reason. There was actually several hurdles you had to do. You just couldn't do it. However, now the new law essentially lowers it, saying, hi, my name's Bob, give me the information. In fact, once you say you're Bob, you no longer even need to do anything else. You just get to tap into this flow willy-nilly. Another new law that's going to be part of the omnibus bill is the investigative powers for the 21st century. 21st century is a big thing, I guess, for laws. Mm-hmm. Now, this relates back to a previous segment, kind of, that we talked about Apple's and their iPhone and keeping tracking information. This law gives police the powers to remotely activate and to access cell phone tracking devices, GPS devices, and the information so they can, again, without you knowing, right, and with very limited, if any, justification, trace everything and everywhere you've gone. Another aspect of the law that actually has a lot of people worried, and maybe we should be worried, is that it also makes it makes you criminally liable for any hyperlink you have that relates to a criminal site, in particular hate speech. So one of the scenarios that you might have is that we've done in the past a show about Israel. Mm-hmm. One of the things is we got some information from other websites, and we linked to it because, you know, instead of making stuff up, we actually kind of like to source some of the stuff we say. So if on that other set website that had some pertinent information about Israel and the Palestinians and their issues, they also happen to have something about we should kill all the purple people, right? Mm-hmm. We can be criminally liable, according to this law, as hate speech promoters ourselves. Now, of course, how these laws will ultimately work out, who knows? So you might be asking, why do we have these laws? Well, in the first place, police departments, law enforcement people like to have more laws. The more power they have, the better. Mm-hmm. Another one is that it lowers the level of what's acceptable reasons for collecting the information in the first place. So it goes from sort of, you know, there needs to be a belief that this person here now is about to or has performed a crime and I have these particular reasons for it, to I think there might be something going wrong somewhere, and it becomes a fishing expedition. Now you might say, well, okay, but it's the internet and that information is all out there. But one of the side effects is what becomes legal in the virtual universe becomes precedent for the physical universe. So it begins with that I can just, you know, go in and take a look at your cell phone records just to see if you maybe you've called someone that was bad. To the point where the police can go into your home and search through your home. I'm going a little crazy here, I know, but in theory, go through your home because they suspect that you might have something to do with something that might be wrong. And they don't need to have the same, you know, well, we need probable cause, we need justification. The bar has been lowered. It makes it much easier for them to do somewhat poor search and seizure type laws. One of the things you might look at, again, is what happened with the G20 in Toronto, right? I mean, you know, they were kind of given some powers and they just sort of ran away with them. Now, the third thing is the idea of networking. You know, it in the international investigative crime world, networks are the big thing, right? Because, I mean, they're doing all this data mining. There's just way too much data for them to actually read. So what they do is they say, well, you went to this website, you went to this website, you went to this website, and this person's a bad person who also went to this website, so you're all three kind of connected to them. And they start doing this networking thing. And a lot of this is done on huge databases where they do data mining. It's automated, so it's done by bots. And there's very little oversight. And some technologists in the field are really worried that not through any maliciousness, but just by accident, a number of people will be sort of labeled as criminals without actually having any criminal activity in their heart. This has actually happened to BC Civil Liberties is trying to defend a person who's associated with organized crime because they were in a restaurant and they waved and someone at that place interpreted the wave to be at the person under surveillance. If you look at the United States, again, a number of cases where people have been put on no-fly zones, have been targeted for investigation, because they have similar names, or they rent out a book that someone else had done. Again, as a skeptic, I'm going down conspiracy theory here, and that's true. And I think we should be aware, but we shouldn't be panicking. But we should be aware that these things are going on. And if we use, again, the scientific method and see what's happening in other countries, there's definitely been a retardation of liberties and freedoms and privacy, not to the point where the New World Order is taking over, but to a point where we should be perhaps a little bit more concerned.
And we should also be asking ourselves, do these new laws positively affect the criminal investigation process? If these new laws are meaning we're catching 50 new terrorists, great. But if they're all they're doing is, you know, mistaking grandma for a terrorist because her name sounds slightly similar to a terrorist name, we have to ask a few questions here.
You know, and that's actually where, again, we get to put on our skeptic hats. In Canada, one of the reasons why these laws are a bit more smoother as far as their introduction goes is they have been actually introduced in other parts of the world, the United States, England, France, and that sort of thing. And the talking points, these are the catchphrases we need to use, like the 21st century, right, is because those things have worked in these other things. And in the same sense, we get to look at them and we can compare, one, the downside, which I've more than overly mentioned, but are there any upsides? And again, in the United States, there seems to be very little upside to it, that the massive expense and the massive limitations of privacy and freedom have not shown to be proven to have any benefit as far as actually capturing terrorists and all that. In fact, it's to the point, as we've mentioned on the show before, that places like the FBI and all that are kind of manufacturing terrorists by taking people who may or may not be sympathetic and providing them the opportunity to do a terrorist act just to say, ha, see, we got one, when they might not have actually ever done that in the first place.
Yeah, it's a very tricky subject, and we'll definitely have to keep our eye on this. And we do encourage listeners, if you have any ideas, maybe you have some reasons why this actually is a benefit, let us know. Email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. Let's go to a commercial break now, and when we come back, we'll have an interview with P.Z. Myers, who is a well-known atheist blogger that we recorded at the Kamloops Imagine New Religion Conference. So stay tuned for that here on the show.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
So vote.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
Yeah, the state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting like more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver. CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
Joining us now on Radio Free Thinker, we have the author of the extremely popular blog Frodingula. He's a professor of biology at UAM University and soon-to-be published author P.Z. Myers. Welcome to the show.
Hello, glad to be here.
So, when is your book coming out?
Oh, it's springtime, next spring. It's pretty much done. It's just a matter of marketing, I guess, which I have no control over. I know nothing about. I just let them do it.
And can you give us a teaser? What's the book going to address?
Oh, it's a book that's changed over time. We're we're in the last bits of finishing it right now, which is mainly cutting stuff out. What we're going to focus on is it's going to be sharp, aggressive humor targeted at religion. So it's my mean atheist book.
Ah, the mean one.
Yes.
Because you're so nice most of the time.
I know, but this is going to be distilled orneriness.
Excellent. Well, you know, the big news right here in Kamloops, aside from the conference, is the quote-unquote removal of the "there's probably no God" slogans from buses. What do you think about this?
I think it's hilarious. No, I actually made a point about that in my talk this evening, is that what's happening is, you know, atheists are putting up these really innocuous signs. That sign is pathetic. It's really mild. And it's generating hissy fits on the part of Christians. And we just kind of got to be kind of smug and gloat over it, that they are extremely effective at pointing out the folly of religion because Christians fall all over themselves to show it to us.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a certain amount of hypocritical attitude in that they're free to put up their signs promoting Jesus and all these other things, and we don't tear down their signs.
No, it's simply a non-issue that... And for instance, in the New York case where the American Atheist put up a sign at that freeway entrance to Manhattan, and right away what happens, the Catholic League turns around and puts up a sign that says, you know, Jesus is real. Fine, that's great.
Right.
Nobody's going to take that down because it actually sets up a nice contrast right there. It serves our purposes just as well, so... No, we want more of this communication.
And it invites debate, which is great for our message. Speaking about sort of the billboard ads in Canada and the U.S., can you sort of comment on the differences between Canada and the U.S. in terms of atheism, but perhaps, I guess, a culture of tolerating religion? Have you noticed a difference?
Oh, that's a tough one because, well, in a lot of ways, no, that I... You know, in the United States even, where we have this bad reputation for having all kinds of fundies and evangelicals and so forth, the problem isn't with the majority of the religious people. The majority of the religious people are just fine with it. They just want to get along. And it's just the crazies. And you've got crazies in Canada, too.
We elected some of them.
Yes. So it's you know, if you compare the populations as a whole, what you get is Canadians have fewer dominating crazies than we do. But, you know, I wouldn't say that Canadians have some special virtue as individuals because, you know, you get the nuts just as much as we do, almost as much.
And you talked about in your talk today maybe some of the reasons why you see this very hardcore, very fundamentalist attitude in America. What were some of your theories about that?
Well, part of it is a reaction that what they're seeing is that in the United States, for instance, for so many years, they have been the dominant culture, that atheists could not speak out because they would be tarred with the brush of communism, you know, the godless communists. So they were very silent for a long, long time, except for notable exceptions like Madeleine Murray or Hare and so forth. And what's happened now is that we're raising our profile. We're poking our heads out and saying, hey, we're here, we're atheists, we're your neighbors, we're your friends, we're your relatives. And what we're seeing right now, I think, is the early stages of a reaction against that. People are shocked that they never expected such a thing, and they're surprised, and so they're lashing out. Give it time, and I think they'll get used to the idea that we're there. They better, because we're not going away.
It'll sort of follow the same trend as the gay movement. At first
yes.
It was outrageous, and now it's sort of like, yeah, of course.
Right. The difference, of course, is that atheists have not had the kind of active oppression that gays have had, that we've pretty much passed as, you know, just regular people on the street. And we don't have any particular behaviors that they can single out and say, oh, well, that's evil, except for the fact that we don't believe in God.
Right.
So, there's a similarity in tactics and the process that's been going on, but I shy away from making a very strong comparison because, you know, atheists haven't been beaten up and tied to barbed wire left overnight to die like gays have.
Exactly, yeah. Well, speaking of atheism. I want to ask you about new atheism. First, do you even consider new atheism a real thing, or is that just is it the same old atheism, but now it's popular?
Yeah, that's it's a weird, weird term, and you know, for a long time it was used simply to distinguish the current crop from the old crop. But when you look at the philosophical positions they're holding, you know, we're not any different in the atheism. There's nothing new there.
Mm-hmm.
That the only difference I would say is not in our position, but in our willingness to be more aggressive in our tactics.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So and that's not a significant difference.
Right.
Yeah.
There are some popular members of the skeptic free thought community who purposely won't label themselves new atheists, perhaps because they don't want to be seen as confrontational, aggressive.
Yeah.
This sort of meta controversy, do you think that's hurting us, or is that just a good argument to have?
Oh, is it? No, because they're stupid and wrong. Well, you know, it's again to bring up the gay movement. That, you know, I want to be careful again. Don't overinterpret this.
Right.
But you know, in the gay movement, there were the flamboyant gays. There were the, you know, the guys who would be out there doing rather radical things prominently in public. And there were a large number of gays who were quiet, business-like, wanted to fit in, just had their own sexual habits, and they didn't want to make it such a big deal. And they had their own tension, their own arguments there. And once again, though, the way it's going to work out is that this is a movement about letting us be ourselves, right? That what we want is free thought, the ability to think any old way we want. And you do not have to be a flamboyant new atheist. There's no requirement that a good atheist has to go out there and chew out Catholics, for instance. There's nothing
right.
like that in there. So it's a non-issue. It's some people having an objection to a way of thought which is, I think, in principle, antithetical to the atheist movement. If you're saying you shouldn't be a flamboyant atheist, like if you're saying you shouldn't be a flamboyant gay, then you're actually working against us.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not going to turn the tables and say, well, you can't be a straight, boring, normal atheist.
Right.
That's fine.
Yeah. What about the intersection between skepticism and atheism? And, you know, I think of, for example, Bill Maher received mm-hmm. an award. The Richard Dawkins Award.
Controversial word, yes.
Exactly. And you know, Bill Maher is somebody who's a very eloquent atheist, but he's also an anti-vaxxer, denier of germ theory. Where do you see that divide?
And it goes the other way, too. Let's not forget that there are prominent skeptics who are Christians.
That's true.
Who don't apply skepticism to their religious beliefs. So, yeah, it's just I think it's just a recognition that we have a lot of different ideas out there. We're not going to turn into cookie-cutter atheists, all right? But, yeah, things like Bill Maher drives me nuts, because, yes, he made a movie about atheism, and I want to credit him and say, yes, you are helping the movement because you're making us more prominent, and you're getting people talking, and this is a great thing. But I think that a core part of my brand of atheism, which is different from other people's atheism, is science and skepticism. That if, you know, we were just talking about new atheists versus whatever the old atheists are going to be called. And I think there's a deeper divide, and that is in the reasons that you're an atheist. And so, like I said, I'm an atheist because science brings it to me. If you talk to Richard Dawkins, it's the same story. But there are lots of atheists who don't really care that much about science, who aren't so interested in science even. And they've arrived at their conclusions by different routes, which are perfectly valid. But that represents a splintering of the community a little bit, too.
Mm-hmm.
We just have to learn to appreciate all these different approaches. Now, anti-vaccination? No, that's just stupid. We simply have to condemn it. That's why there was so much outcry about Bill Maher, is because people don't want to be seen as approving of his woo-wooing anti-vax, anti-medicine message.
I wanted to ask you about the ongoing criticism of groups like the NCSE. The claim that by being too accommodating to religious groups, drives away potential allies and outspoken atheists. Mm-hmm. How, if you were in charge of the NCSA, for instance, how would you improve the situation?
Well, first let me say I would never be in charge of the NCSE because that's a position that requires some diplomatic skills. And I admit that I lack them. If I could be, for instance, a behind-the-scenes man who directed policy while we had other more personable, more approachable people doing the PR work, I would simply remove all the stuff about religion. I would not turn it into an atheist organization. That's mm-hmm. not their goal, because I want NCSE to serve all science teachers, including the ones who have not yet seen the light and lost Jesus. And to do that, they have to be secular. And that means no commitment to atheism, no commitment to any particular religion. The objection that we have to NCSE's tactics right now is that they are actively courting one particular kind of religion, a sort of liberal Christianity. And that's actually an endorsement of religion. That's actually going too far the other way. And the evangelicals and the fundamentalists, they see through this. They know that the NCSE is not favoring their religion at all. They don't see that as conciliatory in the slightest. So why do they do that? I don't know. It's not helping.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about the political divide as well. You blog a lot about politics. A lot of skeptics and a lot of skeptical organizations really don't want to get involved in that. They think that's sort of beyond the realm. That's like in the subjective realm, and science and skepticism is the objective realm.
Yeah.
Do we need to convince groups like, for example, the JREF or CFI to be more involved in politics?
Well, there are management issues there, because if you're a nonprofit, you have to follow certain rules, and some of those rules involve not endorsing particular political parties or candidates. So they can't, unless they want to lose a whole bunch of money in taxes or be arrested or whatever the IRS would do to somebody who violated those rules and who is not an evangelical preacher who can break them at will. so there's a good reason they stay away from this. I think the apolitical approach that many of us take is wrong, because right now there is a clear divide in which party supports science and which does not. And what I worry about more than anything is that, okay, the Republican Party is actively evil. I have no qualms about saying that now because of their policies that they've been pursuing. The Democratic Party isn't much better, but I don't want them to get worse.
Mm-hmm.
And what we need is more open advocacy of skeptical, secular issues to the political party of our choice. And there's no way the Republicans will listen, and there's a slight chance that some of the Democrats will. So that's who I would target our noise machine at. But the politics is a whole other depressing issue, because the Democrats often screw up. Yeah.
That's sort of been the perception here in Canada as well.
Yeah.
Getting past the political hurdle then seems to be a major challenge. In many ways, this seems to resemble the challenge of good science publicity in the media. We train many scientists to know how to talk to a camera and know how to be charismatic. Should we start perhaps training scientists to be good politicians as well?
Oh. Do you train scientists to be charismatic? I haven't seen that.
I've seen a few.
There's a few, but it's nowhere in our skill set. I've been through graduate school and postdocs and all this stuff, and there's nothing in there where they talk about engaging the public, and outreach is actually kind of frowned upon. So it's, I would say that's not quite true. I've been trying to work on various scientists and encouraging them to engage more in reaching out to the public. And I've been telling them to do things like start your blogs and get on Facebook, of all things, or Twitter even, that we need that more public face of science. I wouldn't go quite so far yet as to say politics, because scientists who become politicians stop doing science altogether.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something you can do in your spare time. These are both full-time occupations.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah. Twitter, of course, you can do in 10 minutes in the morning, right? That you can do, unless you get addicted. But politics, no, if you're going to run for office or something, you're committing to running for office full time.
Well, I mean, it does lead me to my next question, and that is, how do you manage to full-time commit to a blog? You're as a professor, you Twitter, you appear in conferences all over. How do you do it?
I have a clone army.
Ah, that explains things.
No. How do I do this? Well, yeah, the one answer is I live in the most boring place on the planet. I live in Morris, Minnesota, which is a small town. There is virtually nothing else to do. So this is my hobby. This is what I like doing for a little lively action in Morris.
Well, you really seem to enjoy it, and comes across really well.
Yeah. What happens here, I think, is it's not so much a commitment of time as a commitment of passion. That if you really, really care about a subject, you'll do it. You'll think about it. You know, for instance, many of my longer blog posts and many of my talks that I give, I write them in my sleep. Mm-hmm. I go to bed thinking about this stuff, and it's percolating in my brain all night long. And I wake up in the morning, and there's a rough draft in my head. So you know, when you do that kind of thing, that really makes efficient use of your time.
Wow, excellent. Well, PZ, thank you for taking additional time to talk to us on
Sure.
Radio Freethinker, and please join us again in the future.
Happy to do so.
CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Radio. Happy. Boing.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker here on CITR, and our thanks to PZ Myers for chatting with us at the Kamloops Imagine the Religion Conference. That was the last of our interviews from that particular conference. Nice way to wrap things up with PZ. It was a very good conference, and hopefully our listeners enjoy the interviews.
Yes, I think it was a good interview. Good interview. His new book on the way, right?
That's right, coming out next spring.
So that will be good. I hope he is ecumenical in his criticism of religions, because one of the problems with some American atheists is they tend to fall on the Republican sort of bandwagon and think that one particular religion is worse than all the others, and that one happens to be the one that's not very strong in the United States. But we'll see how he's.
Well, he's pretty good at sort of offending everybody, so.
And you should be able to offend everyone equally.
That's
right. We've tried to do that on the show constantly.
We believe in equality of offenses, yes. Well, we're kind of running out of time here on the show, so let's go to our skeptical highlights. Don, you have a good one.
I have, actually, it's a show I'm watching that I'm trying to actually make sense out of. It's a series. It's by the same guy who's done The Power of Nightmares. He has a new one out there. It's a new documentary series out there called Machines of Loving Grace, which is sort of about how, you know, somewhere along the line, people said, hey, humans are kind of like machines, the environment's kind of like a machine, so maybe we should look at them as machines, and then maybe we should treat people as machines, and then genes are machines, and we're all gene-carrying machines, and honestly, I'm trying to make sense of it, but anyone out there who's seen the documentary Power of Nightmares know that this producer has very good credentials, and this documentary series he's come out with, like you say, Machines of Loving Grace, seems very interesting. Let me know what you think about it. Maybe you've watched it, you say, oh, this is his big message, because I'm trying to delve the big message, but it's really, really interesting. There's also another thing that's on the podosphere that I think about it, that I think is something we should all be aware of. It's called information bubbles. One of the things that has come to light in a number of studies is that intelligent machines, continue with that theme, like Google Search, will customize your search engine to things that it thinks you're interested in, which in the one sense, if you're looking for, you know, new computers, fast computers is great. But if you sit in there and you're doing vaccination studies and it knows that you're an anti-vaxxer, its search engine mechanics will give you results that are more skewed to one particular spectrum of the world than another, and you start getting these information bubbles that build up around it. That if you're on Facebook, that, you know, things you like or things that you might like are tailored to what it thinks you're going to be, and you tend to lose out on a whole plethora of other ideas, other people, that sort of thing. It's something to be aware of. And again, like I say, there have been a few podcasts out there. I believe someone has written a book called The Information Bubble, that just deals with this idea that, you know, as we rely more and more on Google search, that we may be limiting our exposure to other ideas, other thoughts out there. That means we might be a bit more proactive in trying to do that.
Absolutely. Use your librarians, folks. You have a university library for a reason, and you have trained professionals in there for a reason. Ask them. They have a wealth of knowledge to share with you. So take that resource and use it, folks. My skeptical highlight is the first international Boing Boing meetup. Boing Boing, of course, is the science and technology magazine many people are familiar with. And today, June 7th at 7 p.m., a group of science, quote-unquote mutants, as they are described, are going to meet up at Granville Island near the Duck Pond, and they're each bringing a wonderful thing, i.e. your favorite significant object, coveted curiosity, conversation piece, or mysterious item to the meetup, where they're going to discuss said item and then, I guess, hang out for a while. I just heard about this today. It sounds really fascinating. So check it out, and hopefully there'll be some more Boing Boing meetups, because it sounds like a cool new thing here in Vancouver. Again, today, June 7th, 7 p.m. at Granville Island near the Duck Pond.
Does this thing have to be an actual item, or can it be metaphysical, like my sense of curiosity or something?
I think they want an item. I mean, maybe if you had a picture of an item, that would work.
Okay.
Yeah.
That would be good.
Okay. Well, we're running out of time here on the show, but we do encourage our listeners, please visit our website at www.radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to our podcast. You can do that on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. And of course, email your ideas, suggestions, and thoughts to radio.freethinker@gmail.com. This is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
Bye-bye, everybody.